Welcome to A Breath of Fresh Air, celebrating the best in innovation and leadership from those that are creating a positive change in the events industry. A podcast provided to you by the Professional Conference Organisers Association. My name is Libby Ray, and I'm delighted to be your host. Today's podcast is brought to you by ICMI Speakers and Entertainers. ICMI is one of Australia's best known and most trusted talent agencies for speakers, entertainers and hosts, to which we are actually welcoming one of their speakers today. Michael McQueen is a multi-award winning speaker, trend forecaster and best-selling author of 9 books. With clients including KPMG, Pepsi and Cisco, he has helped some of the world's best and most successful brands navigate disruption and maintain momentum. In addition to featuring regularly as a commentator on TV and radio, Michael is a familiar face on the international conference circuit, having shared the stage with the likes of Bill Gates, Dr. John Maxwell, and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Michael has spoken to over 500,000 people across 5 continents since 2004 and is known for his engaging, entertaining, and practical conference presentations. Having been formally named Australia's Keynote Speaker of the Year, Michael has been inducted into the Professional Speakers Hall of Fame. Michael's unique perspective and innovative thinking when it comes to communication and events makes me very excited to have him on the show today. Thank you, Michael, and welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Libby.
Michael is actually a headline speaker for the PCOA conference in December 2022. Today, we get a peek behind the curtains of what guests have to look forward to. Now, to get into it, Michael, I'd love to start with my first question, which is, how did you find yourself in your role as a speaker? Was it a moment or a journey that inspired you?
Yeah, it's a good question, because typically speakers are attracted to the profession either because they're content focused, either they've got deep expertise or research in a certain area, they want to bring that to a larger audience, or they're attracted to the craft rather than necessarily the content. So for me, it was probably more the craft. I was always interested in, like, I love listening to great communicators. In fact, you know, I guess if there was a moment where I really wanted to do this as a profession randomly, it was very young. So I was only 8 when I first decided I'd love to do this, bizarrely. So I was at a conference of my parents' work, and the babysitter had fallen through. So we all got dragged along, my brothers and I, to the back of this conference and sat there quietly trying to behave ourselves. And there was a speaker on the platform who was an American speaker talking about personality profiles. And she was just superb. She was so engaging. I mean, she had probably 2,000 or 3,000 people in this room just in sort of rapt silence. And I was so intrigued by that skill. I thought, that is awesome. And I remember walking out and saying to mum and dad that afternoon, that's what I want to do. And I remember they're probably just politely like, oh, what a lovely idea. You know, as kids say things that never really follow through. But interestingly, that really did stick. So all the way through even high school and university, it was sort of on my radar. How do you get into that world, professional communicating and research and writing? Met some people at PSA, what was NSAA at the time, the Speakers Association, got some mentoring and sort of and went from there.
Wow, what a great story, starting from 8 years old. what age were you when you were first in front of people talking and sort of standing there leading people?
Yeah, probably I would have started off about age 22. I essentially started full-time doing this, and initially my work was in school. So at the time, a lot of high schools around New South Wales in particular had funding for what they called school-to-work readiness. So it was all about hiring people from industry to come into schools and help, you know, kids prepare for life outside of school. And so that's where I started my business and my career, really focusing on the key funding outcomes of that whole initiative and trying to make my content relevant for that. So Initially, I was in high schools right around the country, often in really rough areas with really rough students, which is an amazing apprenticeship to cut your teeth on as a speaker. So I started at that point about age 22. I'm pretty much full-time and have been doing it ever since.
Wow, fantastic. I think you must be one of the very small minority of children at the age of 8 who actually grew up to be what they thought they were going to be. That's very impressive.
That's right, because normally it's like, I want to be an astronaut or a fireman or something, isn't it? But no, speaker randomly in it and followed through.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I guess this really brings me into my next question is, what has been the most difficult part of your journey to becoming a professional speaker?
I think certainly those first years of obscurity, you know, just doing the student schools circuit, because you know, typically in schools, they have no sort of understanding of the variety of different speakers that you get. Obviously, in corporate land, we're used to having people who are comedians and researchers, and then you've got the motivational, inspirational speakers. But from most schools' perspective, all they ever call an outside speaker is a motivational speaker. So you'd sort of go in and you get these sort of these eye rolls from the careers advisor or the year 10 form coordinator who'd be like, oh, here we go. He's a motivational speaker. And I vividly remember a few, you know, many times actually, where you'd have like a hot school hall, gymnasium type setup at a high school in Western New South Wales. And the teacher would basically say, shut up and sit down. This guy's name's Michael. He's going to motivate you. And like, they'd basically push me on stage and off I was, you know, like, and it was the most awkward setup. You know, you're sort of up against it from the outset, a whole lot of, you know, year 10 students who didn't want to be there, didn't want to be motivated. And I wasn't really there to motivate them anyway. That wasn't the focus, but it was just like, that was a really tricky time. Like, I remember vividly there was an event. I did a speaking tour around sort of central Queensland and northern Queensland, went to a juvenile justice centre in Townsville, which was actually a remarkably interesting experience. The inmates were like super warm and interesting and engaged, but that afternoon went to a local high school in Townsville. And like all these kids sitting on the floor in the library, and it was the only air-conditioned building in the school, I think. And so they were all sitting on the floor, about 160 of them all crammed onto the floor. And right in front of me, this one kid just halfway through the session picked up his pen and stabbed my foot, like through my shoe, into my toe with a pen. I'm like, what is this? Like that was those moments,
no.
Times 300 or 400, like, you know, just kids. I remember being at a school in Western Sydney and like this massive punch up and there were knives and this was like mid-session in school. So it was all that. That was probably the most tricky time because speaking is often a very lonely profession anyway. You're sort of out there on your own, but particularly just sort of, you know, threshing it out school after school, day after day. That was a really tricky time for often really low fees, but man, it was such a great apprenticeship.
Wow, that's incredible. And I just wonder, I mean, sticking something out for such a long period of time that was challenging for you, how much do you attribute that to your ability to be resilient and keep on moving now?
Yeah, I think it's got to be part of it, really. And I guess anyone who's done anything that took, you know, more than a few weeks or a few months to come to fruition knows what that's like. You know, those times where you're like, am I insane? Like, is this actually going to play out? Is this going to work? And I mean, that's where mentoring and just connecting with people a few steps down the line from you is so helpful because you can sort of see what's coming next if you just stick at it. But I remember like a few mentors at the time, just some of the wisdom and encouragement they give me. One in particular, I remember it was just this encouragement that, you know, public victories are always preceded by private ones. You know, like there'll be points in the future, and the encouragement was there'll be points where you'll be, you know, you'll be probably prominent and well known, getting awards or the accolade, but those accolades publicly represent that the years and the hundreds of moments, thousands of moments of private victories of just doing the stuff where no one's there to applaud, no one even notices. And that was the, so I think I always had that perspective. I've just got to keep doing the basics, keep winning the private victories, and hopefully eventually one day the public ones will come.
Yeah, wow, that's a really good point. And you've written a lot about momentum, and it sounds to me that it really was about doing those hard yards and then gaining that momentum just at a particular point, everything just taking off for you.
Yeah, and I guess that's the encouragement I give to listeners, particularly in the events industry where, I mean, we've just come off the back of what has been such an acutely difficult 2 years. And right now, as I'm seeing things come back online, and I mean, there are so many events that I'm sort of, all the events from the last 2 years that are now all happening. So there's this mad rush of events, and it's great to be back out with clients, with crowds, largish venues. Like I had, I think, 1,200 people at the Convention Centre in Melbourne on Saturday, and it was like, that's the first large event really since early 2020. So it's such a joy to be back out and about. But what I'm noticing is the speakers agencies, the PCOs, the AV companies that are now picking up work really quickly are the ones that just kept doing those basics, even in the midst of like what was a really dark time for the industry. So I think now that's just a challenge for all of us is, you know, just continually being consistent with the stuff that makes a difference. And often those are the relationship focused things. And it's been really hard throughout the last 2 years. Like it's been hard for all of us really. But I think now we're seeing that the fruit of that, you're now seeing those organisations that are coming out of this in a strong way.
And speaking of the last 2 years and the catastrophic impact on the events industry, what automation and virtual innovations, probably from those that are continuing to do some things throughout that period of time, do you think will be actually here to stay?
Well, I think we've all learned a lot, haven't we? I mean, gosh, at the start of 2020, I'd only ever done one virtual event, and I'm embarrassed to say, I remember it was an event for a group of financial advisors on the Sunshine Coast. I was speaking that morning in Melbourne, and there were no flights that would get me there in time. So they sort of said, and it was quite brave of them, they said, oh, would you mind maybe just doing it as a video, dialing in via Zoom? And I mean, at that point, I'd like a Zoom-free account. I'd never really used Zoom much, but I'm like, I'll give it a shot. So I remember sitting like in front of my laptop doing this just to the cameras on my laptop screen thinking, oh, this is probably not great, but I don't know if, you know, this is actually going to be a thing. So I may as well not put too much time and energy into it because this is a bit of a, you know, a bit of a random thing. Not realizing that 4 months later, everything would be virtual. And I think we've all had to figure that out so quickly. And it's amazing when you look back, I don't know what your first meeting you had where you had to run an event on Teams or Zoom or, you know, GoToWebinar, and like how terrifying that was. Like just before you go live, like just none of us really knew what we were doing. So I think the learning curve has been steep. What that means is a lot of those skills, almost that muscle memory we've built over the last 2 years, will continue into the future. There are always going to be the clients and people who dial in remotely for our events because they know they now can. And so I think certainly hybrid events will become the norm. Using some of the tools we've had to engage with to make that experience virtually useful or relevant, engaging for clients, things like Mentimeter I found really helpful in terms of polling and connecting with people who are dialing in. I think all that sort of stuff will continue. I think the big difference as we look at the next few years is we're going to decide which sort of events do we need to gather in person for and which ones don't we? And the ones we do gather in person for, they're going to be fun, experience rich, in need of a PCO, by the way. Like, you know, it's not going to just be about, you know, pile a whole lot of people into the Hilton boardroom and turn on the lights and turn on the microphones. It's got to be far more engaging and rich if you're going to go to the trouble of having an in-person event, because all the transactional stuff where you just want to, you know, get your sales team together for a quick update this quarter, that'll happen on Zoom probably now, but it's the experience-rich stuff that'll come back to face-to-face. So I think we are going to see hybrid, but the things that are face-to-face, even though they might have a hybrid element, we'll probably see the nature of those shift a little bit.
I tend to agree. I certainly believe that there's not many people out there saying we can't wait to get back to normal, because we don't really know what normal's going to be anymore, and, you know, the future's different and there's lots of opportunity, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think the encouragement I would just give is, I think what we're going to discover in 2022 and probably in next year, 2023 as well, our big learnings are going to be what hasn't changed over the last 2 years. Like, we've talked so much about what has changed throughout the pandemic, and I think it's a really important topic, and we've spent a lot of time trying to identify that from an events industry perspective. I think the key learnings moving forward is, like, what's not changed in terms of human nature, our desire to connect, and how we'll actually see a lot of those things come back. Even like cinema going is expected to be back where it was by 2023 pre-pandemic. So like, people are actually flocking back to cinemas as quickly as they can, even though, you know, in the early stages of the pandemic, the discussion was, is this the end of movie theaters entirely? The answer is no. People still love the big screen. They want to go out and have that spectacle of going to a movie. And so I think it's a bit the same with events. You know, people want to gather. They want to be together with their colleagues and peers and have that sense of energy that's in a room when you gather face to face that you just don't get online. So I think we're going to learn very quickly the things that we've missed, the things that haven't changed, and a lot of that is really good news for the events industry.
Fantastic. That's great news. Music to all of our ears, that's for sure. Now, I'd love to pick your brain a little bit. What technology trends are you forecasting for 2022 and beyond?
Well, I mean, there's so many things really we could look at that are coming in the next sort of 12 to 18 months. I think from a generational standpoint, one that I've been looking at pretty closely is the trends related to Generation Z as they increasingly make their presence known. I mean, we've talked a lot about millennials over the years, but a big part of my research over the last 2 years has been like that post-millennial group, that Gen Z cohort, because, you know, they're getting grown up. Like, they're all sort of 22, 23 years of age. So we're dealing with a point where, depending on the industry you're in, you may well have 10 to 15% of an audience at an event now, a Gen Z. And so over the next 10 years, that's going to become far more significant. I think I was reading, you know, McCrindle research piece that came out last week. By 2030, 31% of the workplace will be Gen Z. So that's a big trend to keep an eye on in terms of the technologies that group are using, how to connect with them, what their values are as a group. But in terms of technology, I think what's going to be really interesting over the next 12 months is this concept of the metaverse going from being something that's a little bit fringy and a bit hypey at the moment to becoming probably far more ingrained in daily life. And one of the things I shared at the webinar we did the other week was what we're seeing happen with Horizon Workrooms, which is the platform that Facebook, or Meta as they're now called, have built. And what's interesting is Horizon Workrooms and Microsoft have built something similar. Another one called Arthur is designed for workplace collaboration with smallish to medium-sized teams. We're going to see these start to change the way people gather and connect. So I think that's probably the stuff to watch. Looking at virtual reality, particularly that the applications of the metaverse for organizations and businesses, this is going to be a big one over the next year, probably the next 2 or 3 years as well. So that's certainly one I'd suggest to watch.
Fantastic. I haven't actually heard of that. I'm really looking forward to looking into the workrooms. That sounds really interesting. Now, Michael, you talk a lot about Gen Y and Gen Z.
Yeah.
In your opinion, is the biggest cultural shift between Y and Z, or if there's been a bigger, more noticeable difference between generations before?
I don't think that'll be the biggest shift. No, I think the biggest one was from Gen X to Gen Y. Because Gen Y or the millennials, and Gen Y and millennial are the same group, different names, the reason they were so significantly different is because they were the children of the baby boomers. So you had this massive cohort of parents who were different. Then in between you had the Gen Xs, and then the Gen Y or millennials were the kids of the boomers. And so that the fact that the baby boomers were such a significant generation in terms of their size, and also just, I mean, think about baby boomers, how much social change they've seen happen in their lives. As they raised their kids, we saw some really sizable shifts there. I mean, like a big year was 1979, so that was the International Year of the Child. And that was often deemed the year that kicked off what was then known as the era of self-esteem. You know, when you had a whole generation of Gen Ys coming through being told, unlike Gen X, who were basically told that, you know, you're better to be seen and not heard, Gen Y were raised in an era where it was like, you know, you are special, you're magnificent, you can do anything you want to do, be anything you want to be, all these messages of self-esteem. So that was a significant gear shift in the way we approach parenting. That's played out in schools and now the workplace, where you've got a lot of Gen Y or millennial employees who just need to be thanked and congratulated a whole lot more than older generations do. So, like, that's probably the bigger generational shift. With Generation Z, there certainly are going to be differences, but a number of them will be technology related. Even the fact that for Generation Z, email is really old news. They don't use email anywhere near as much as other generations. For them, the sort of social media platforms they're on are very different. So, for instance, you know, Facebook, I think the usage of Facebook amongst 16-year-olds has dropped from like 92% to the mid-40s in terms of a percentage of users of Facebook. They're all on Instagram, but more importantly, TikTok. So the platforms they're using are very different. So those are some of the changes to really watch. Like from an, I guess, a values perspective, sustainability and equity are super important to Gen Z, partly because it's been their only frame of reference. They've grown up in an era where that's been front of mind. So there are certainly some big changes happening with Gen Z, but I think if you want to look at the biggest shift, it was between that Gen X group and Generation Y or the millennials. And we're still seeing that play through in terms of the way organizations interact with each other.
That's really interesting. And probably leads a little bit into the next question, which is, how do you see the significant changes in the way we interact impacting the live event world, whether that be positively or negatively?
Well, yeah, I think one of the ones I've been watching closely over the last few months, just as I'm working with clients and I'm seeing the sort of events clients are organising, I think that the focus on having off-site events that are very deliberately crafted to bring their remote and hybrid workforce together for a few days off-site, you know, deep dives of some leadership training, some working together and collaborating, a whole lot of fun. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, because as we see hybrid work become increasingly normal, this is coming at the cost of a few things. Big one it's coming at the cost of is collaboration, like actually genuinely sharing. And, you know, although I think probably the whole water cooler discussion's been overstated, you know, like the water cooler, just gathering in the workplace leads to innovation. It doesn't always. It doesn't always lead to innovation. It's got to be a specific type of interaction that actually is useful from a collaboration standpoint. But what we are seeing is that sending people home to work remotely, even if it's only half the week, for instance, is changing the way that teams are collaborating. So there's a study released last year from Microsoft. They surveyed 61,000 employees across, you know, every conceivable jurisdiction worldwide, a huge study. And they looked at how people were communicating when they were working remotely. And it was pretty staggering. What they found is the type of communication was really different. People were collaborating, but only within functional teams, not across functional teams. And often the types of communication were what they referred to as asynchronous communication. So it often wasn't that organic back and forth that we have in offices and when we're working together face to face. So I think from an events perspective, what this means is a lot of clients right now are focusing on building these events and opportunities to bring their teams together to create that sense of culture and togetherness. So good example of this, 2 weeks ago, Salesforce actually took out a lease for a significant property, a wellness retreat about 70 miles south of San Francisco called, how's this for an American name? Trailblazer Ranch is the name of this property, okay? And it's all about bringing people together for 2 and 3 day stays. Some of it's about wellness and sort of, you know, recuperating, but a lot of it's about bringing staff, particularly new staff in the organization together to meet their colleagues, feel a part of something, but also to get a sense of what the culture of the business is, because culture is really hard to build when you're working remotely. So I think we're going to see a lot more of those sort of offsite events that, again, PCOs or event planners will need to be a key part of in terms of putting them on. But that's going to be the stuff, perhaps more than, you know, the half day, bring all the sales team together in a conference ball, in a hotel ballroom type function, which is what we've done in the past. Good news is those sort of offsite events, a lot more interesting, a lot more fun to put on, okay? And so we'll probably also find there's a lot more margin for those sort of events too from a client perspective, because, you know, they see the economic value for those in some big ways. So I think that's going to be one of the big changes from an event perspective.
Yeah, I can really feel the benefits really being highlighted moving forward for the need for face-to-face events. And some of those events you were talking about just then are certainly some that I would want to attend. It sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
I'd love to know, obviously, we're all striving for innovation. We want to be out there changing the world and doing the best we possibly can. What do you believe makes an innovative leader?
It's a really good question, because that's a lot of what I've spent time over the last few years looking at, especially. So back in sort of 2012, 2013, I embarked on a research project that led to a book that came out called Winning the Battle for Relevance. And a lot of that was looking at brands and organizations that had massive success and then lost it. You know, what are the things that cause an organization or a team who've been at the cutting edge to lose their edge, to lose momentum or lose relevance, become obsolete over time? And we've seen so many examples of that. You know, the Blackberries, the Blockbusters, the Kodaks of the world, they're the big ones, but we've seen so many of those similar stories or dynamics play out with smaller businesses and teams as well. So I've been really intrigued by this question of what is it that causes a leader or a team to lose that innovative edge? And I think the things, if I consider the last sort of probably 5 to 10 years of researching this and thinking about it deeply and working with clients around this, probably three themes come to mind. First one is intellectual humility, like just being always open to learning, always open to being challenged in your approach, always willing to listen to other perspectives. And you know, the old saying is true, the moment you think you've made it, you've passed it. And you often see that with leaders. Once you've had a whole lot of success, I often refer to, you know, a dynamic I call the intoxication of success. You know, you think you've made it because everyone's saying how brilliant you are and you're winning awards left, right, and center. In fact, there was an interesting study done a few years ago coming up with what they called the cover curse. The number of times where, you know, people who'd been on the cover of business publications within 2 years had a significant crash and burn within their businesses. And when they looked at why that was, it was because they got to the point where they thought, you know, we've got it figured out. You know, this, we've got the winning formula, then they lock it in stone. So I think humility, always being willing to try different things is probably the first element. The second is curiosity, which is, you know, always staying in the posture and the position of student. Again, it ties into this idea of always looking to learn, but always being willing to rethink the things you've assumed to be true. And Adam Grant wrote a brilliant book last year, that probably my favorite book last year that I read, called Think Again. And I would highly recommend listeners get a copy of Think Again, because he looks at this whole approach of how do we develop a mindset where we're always willing to reconsider the things that we've always taken for granted. And you know, he has this great quote in the book. He said, you know, we laugh at people who use Windows 95. But we ourselves often cling to ideas and perspectives or opinions we formed in 1995. And we've got to, you know, I guess that curiosity is important. I guess the last one would be audacity, just that willingness to take risks, to continually do things that are out of the box. I love that insight from Frank Wilczek, who won the Nobel Prize back in 2004. And he said, if you're not making mistakes, you're not working on hard enough problems. And I reckon there's such truth in that idea of, you know, in our roles with, this is hard for all of us, but we've always got to continually push ourselves and do things that are new and different and outside the box, because if we don't, we'll lose that innovative edge over time.
Wow. They're really, really great points, actually, and certainly things that are really hitting home for me personally. Which brand or leader has been the most disruptive in 2021, do you think? Or have you noticed?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's gone down in the last sort of 12 to 18 months. I mean, this is where, I mean, going back to one of the points we mentioned before, I think one of the things I miss most about in-person events when we were doing everything online is I stopped learning as much. I learn so much from audience members. I often after events, I'll be chatting to one or two or three people, often at like a book signing table, and they'll just, you know, share something they've read, something they've thought about, or an experience they've had, a company they've worked for. And I'm like, I've never even heard that, thought about that, considered that. And I'll be often writing notes, and I'll then go and look at it afterwards. And last week in Brisbane, I was at an event, a live event, and there was a guy in the audience who was just like, he was just an awesome guy who just like nerded out on SpaceX. He just loves SpaceX. He watches all of the clips of every launch. He knows all the details of every rocket they've put into space, and like a real fanboy of Elon Musk's. And I was chatting to him for after this event, I reckon for 45 minutes, and he was telling me about what SpaceX are doing with Starlink, which is the satellites they're putting up in relatively low orbit for internet access. And I'd read a bit about it, but I didn't realize just how massive this is. And I think if you look at the most disruptive brand of the last 12 months, I reckon SpaceX and what they're doing with Starlink is probably the one that would win the award from my perspective. What they're doing has the potential to massively disrupt internet service providers globally. I mean, if you can get access to stable, fast, low latency internet anywhere in the world via satellite, instead of relying on fiber cables that are sketchy as in Australia, that's game changing. And we noticed even in the last week, Elon Musk has actually mobilized a whole pile of satellites over the Ukraine to give Ukrainians free internet when all the telecommunications networks been destroyed by the Russians. So like this, I think we're seeing some great examples of this sort of tech, which is a significant disruption to an industry that obviously is very lucrative right now. So to me, they'd probably get the award for the most disruptive or innovative of the last year.
I think the other really exciting thing about them is it really equals out education opportunity for everyone in the world. And so
we
get a lot more disruption and innovation out of just providing an equal opportunity to education.
Well, that's it. And I was reading a piece of research from the World Bank last week, and they said that so there's about 1 in 5 jobs are estimated to be able to be done anywhere remotely. But if you haven't got stable internet, so if you get a parts of the world where the internet is sketchy, that ratio goes only down to 1 in 26 jobs can be done remotely. So like the internet access is the great leveler. And so like you look at a place like Estonia was the first country in the world to bring in internet access as a fundamental human right a few years ago. And I think, so what we're seeing happen in terms of what Starlink are doing for democratizing internet access is massive in so many ways.
Fantastic. I've got a little bit of a cheeky one for you, Michael.
Yeah.
What's an insult you've received that you're proud of?
What a great question. I reckon it wouldn't be like a specific insult, but it would be like a general category of insult that I got early on when I started doing this, was that I was just too young. You know, when I was young, and I was 21, I was 22 actually when I started speaking full time. And early on, even though I did most of my stuff in schools, every now and again I'd, you know, get asked to speak at a local chamber of commerce or something like that. And you'd have people in the audience and they'd often say, it's really valuable, but, you know, wait till you've got a bit of life experience. You know, almost like just talking down to you because you were young. And I remember that. I always took that on board because I'm like, you've always got to learn. I've always got to take this stuff on board. I get it that, you know, I've always, you know, got to be mindful of my age. Fortunately, having no hair from about like 23 helped because you look a bit older when you've got a semi-bald head. But it was interesting. That was probably the biggest insult of just like that whole thing of like, you just, you know, you've not earned the right to speak. You've not earned the right to be on the platform, which I completely understand. And so what I did is I sort of use that to my advantage because I'm like, okay, well, if I'm too young to be taken seriously in a corporate environment, which I sort of get, I am young, I understand that. How does this become an asset? So that's really where I positioned myself early on as like, you know, so having deep expertise in working with Gen Ys or millennials, because that's what I'd spent years doing in school. So I could basically go into, you know, a corporate boardroom and say, well, look, you know what, you want to engage your future customers, your future staff. I've just spent 3.5 years working with like 80,000 of them. Here's what they think. And suddenly being young was a massive asset because it was almost like I was an ambassador of youth culture and they're all terrified by this next group coming through because they didn't understand them. So it's funny though now, like now I've just turned 40 in the last month or so. And it's funny how now you get to a point where I speak to some of my colleagues and they're like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm sort of cool and young enough anymore. I'm like, how interesting where you spend a chunk of your time in life not being old enough to be taken seriously. And then all of a sudden people start questioning their relevance because they're getting too old. I'm like, is it like a 4-minute window in life where you're like the perfect age? Like I think that's a tricky thing for all of us is to bear in mind, you know, how do you work with where you're at in life? Because, you know, I think every age group's got something to offer and we've got to be so careful not to discount people because of their age one way or the other. But that's probably the biggest insult I got a whole lot in the early days.
Well, it really did come full circle then, didn't it?
It has.
Back to sort of your own life and motivation. What are some of the routines or rituals that you have in place to motivate you?
Well, for me, I'm an A-type personality, so I'm pretty driven by goals. I love having a bit of a plan, a bit of a goal. I find the lowest energy time for me is like early January each year when there's nothing going on. You know that time of the year when you don't even know what day of the week it is? Like, is it a Tuesday or Saturday? Who knows? I often find my energy really dips. I don't enjoy that sort of listless, floating sort of vibe. For my wife, she loves that. That's her happy space. But I love, you know, goals and a plan. So for me, the things that motivate me is having a really clear goal for, and not too far out. Like, I'm like, in the next few days, I want to get this chapter of a book written, or I want to work on this session or do this interview with someone and like then write it up and produce a blog post, and really specific time defined goals. I find that for me works really well. I guess, you know, you often hear about people from a health perspective who do interval training. They sprint and they stop, sprint and then they stop. I do that in life. So I run really hard and then I intentionally rest really hard and then I run really hard. I find that the best rhythm for me. I tend to be most productive when I'm doing that. From a daily perspective, I've journaled for years. This idea of if your life's, you know, worth anything, it's worth writing about or recording or reflecting on. And so I find journaling and just reflecting on what I'm learning, where I'm being stretched and challenged, then going back to journal 6 and 12 months on and looking at, you know, where I'm up to and where things are growing and changing. I find that a really useful self-reflection tool. So I've done that probably since, gosh, I'm going to sound like such a nerd now, like probably 16 or 17. I remember a mentor saying, you know, great people keep journals. And, you know, great men, he said at the time, but like, you know, great humans, you know, generally male, female, have always kept journals throughout history. I'm like, well, I'd like to do something great. So maybe journaling is a good idea. So I've actually done that for a lot of years, and I do find that really helpful.
And what a great legacy to leave as well. I mean, it's really your whole life in pages. It's going to be fantastic.
Well, it is, but do you really? I don't know if I'd ever want anyone to read my journals, because some of you look back and go, gosh, how embarrassing that I was wrapped up on that thing or that idea. And I'm like, it seems so futile and ridiculous. And, you know, it's embarrassing, I guess, in many ways when you look at your old journals, but there's such value too in that, I reckon.
What's one thing about your field of expertise that almost no one agrees with you about or just can't get a handle on?
This is a good question, isn't it? The one thing I find interesting, I mean, you've probably seen the data like I have, that if you want to produce content online that gets the most engagement, it's going to be video content. And I'm like, I don't know about that. I very rarely watch videos online unless I've got subtitles, because I'm always somewhere where I can't have the sound up. And so I read voraciously. I read probably 3 or 4 newspapers a day, like all the technology or business newspapers. I read online magazines. I read blog posts. Like, I read a lot. But video content, it'll pop up in my LinkedIn feed. And if it hasn't got subtitles that I can read as I go along, I'll just keep scrolling. So I know that the conventional wisdom is everything's got to be video. I find for me, I reckon there's still a place for text. Text is very shareable. It can be, you know, printed, copied and pasted, reproduced. I find a lot of my stuff gets reproduced by clients in their own information, gets credited back to me, whether it be their quarterly updates or what. I think that's really useful from a marketing perspective. So I guess that's one thing that I write a lot. I produce a lot of written content. I do heaps of video, but for me, I still find if I had the choice of writing something or doing a video, I can still err toward the writing side.
I guess it comes down to that there are so many different types of people that communicate in so many different types of ways. So there's really no one answer. You have to really be everything to everyone.
Yeah, I know. It's tricky, isn't it? It's exhausting at times.
Yeah, totally.
But you do need, and at the same time, you can't be all things to all people. So you do have to sort of pick a lane. I find that with social media. I do all of my, or most of them. I Instagram I do for personal stuff, Facebook for personal stuff, lots of business stuff for LinkedIn. But I'm not on Snapchat yet. I probably need to do Snapchat. I'm also not on TikTok yet because that's not where my customers are. But it does get to that point where, like, how many of these things do I need to be across every single day? Like, it can be quite exhausting. So just choosing which platforms and then using those platforms really well, rather than trying to do everything and doing a mediocre job of it.
Great tips there. I think that's definitely something that a lot of us need to live by. Now, before we wrap up, I've got 5 super quick questions for you.
Okay.
All right. So the first one, best book of all time.
Well, this was hard. I love books. Lots of books. A book that I read probably every year or two because I find it's profound and really wise in terms of insights on human nature. It might be a surprise. It's called The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. Brilliant book. Just looking at like the human nature and the metaphysical side of human nature. So I reckon that'd be probably one of the best books of all time from my perspective.
greatest event you've ever attended?
Conference over in America. Every year, I've spoken three times at it over the years, called the Rotary International Assembly. So all of Rotary's leaders from around the world, 120-something countries, all gather together. And on the last night, they have this gala where everyone wears their traditional dress, their costumes from their home country. And it is the most inspiring, culturally rich, positive, world-changing type event. Yeah, that's probably my favorite I've ever done.
Favorite city in the world?
I think Vienna. Vienna's just so effortlessly beautiful. I could go there any day of the week and happily spend a week just roaming the streets.
And what is your greatest inspiration, or who?
Oh, it's interesting, isn't it? I think probably the greatest moments of inspiration for me would be those light bulb moments. The things that inspire me is when I see audiences get something for the first time. I find that the most inspiring part of my job. The thing that gives me most joy and inspires me to keep doing what I do is like just those moments where you get off stage and someone will say, you know, I've never considered that. That just shifted my perspective, changed my view on myself or my team or the future or technology or whatever. To me, that's the stuff that inspires me the most. And that's the stuff I've missed the most, by the way, with virtual stuff, because you just don't get any of that, do you, when you're working virtually?
Now, am I more likely to find you climbing a mountain or jumping out of a plane?
Oh, probably neither, really. But if I had to choose, like I'm a water guy. Like give me anything on the water and I'm a happy man. But so boats are my jam, okay? But I'm jumping out of a plane, I have done once, and it was pretty awesome. But I thought once was probably enough. But if I had to choose between the two, to be jumping from the plane.
That's fantastic. That would be my choice as well. Maybe you could jump out of a plane into a body of water.
Oh, yes, look at that.
Now, Michael, how can our listeners find you online or book you?
Well, I guess, like I said, I tend not to do all the platforms because you just sort of can't. But LinkedIn, I probably am the most active on. So if you want to look for my LinkedIn profile, what I do every day about 8:45 a.m. is I do an update of whatever trends or data I've seen come out the night before. Some of that would be relevant for the events industry, some more broadly. But you know, that could be useful if people want to connect there. And my website is michaelmcqueen.net. And there's obviously all my stuff on there, whole video library of different content, blog posts, details on stuff I talk about at conferences, all that jazz. So yeah, michaelmcqueen.net from a website perspective.
Michael McQueen, thank you so much for joining us. Absolute pleasure to talk to you this afternoon. The audience will be able to see Michael at the big stage at the PCOA conference 11 to 13 December in Hobart. Thank you so much to ICMI speakers and entertainers for today's podcast. And of course, thank you to the PCOA for making this podcast possible. My name is Libby Ray, and I'll see you next week for another breath of fresh air. Until then, be kind and stay connected.